It's Ronnie McGee with you for the next 2 hours here on Pulse 98.4. We've got a cracker of a show. Simple Minds, I Travel, from a great album called Empires and Dance. And I was listening to that this afternoon, much to the disdain of my lovely lady. And what a wonderful album from 1980. Now, I have a guest in the studio. I'm not going to tell you who he is just now. I'll introduce him after we hear a couple of tracks from The Who. It's Pulse 98.4 on a Wednesday night. I'm Ronnie McGee. Now, I have a special guest in the studio. My guest has been at the forefront of Scottish music, journalism and radio for over 40 years now. His book, One Love, One Life, was published barely 2 weeks ago. Welcome to Pulse 98.4, Billy Sloan.
Hi, Ronnie. How are you doing? It's really good to be here.
It is great to have you on the show. The book came out just about a fortnight ago, and the reaction has been pretty good all over social media, and you have been on the promo trail, and in fact, you did 2 sessions at the Bar London Sunday.
Yeah, I mean, this is kind of new for me, because normally I'm the guy who's asking the questions, but I've been turning up at these things, and, you know, people have been interviewing me, or I've just been talking. But, you know, before I even tell you any more about that, the reason I reached out to you was, you know, we've never really met. This is the first time. I literally met you 5 minutes ago when I turned up at the station. And I kind of, I watch what you do, and I really love what you do, because what comes across when I read your playlist and I read your little, and I'm a complete technophobe, but I kind of stumble across your little Facebook posts, and what comes across is that you're really passionate about music. So I wanted to try and sort of, you know, get to people who, like me, enthused about music. I just didn't want to turn up to any, you know, Tom, Dick and Harry in a radio station. So that's why I put the call in. You very kindly invited me along. So it's great to be here, because I can tell from what you do and from watching what you do over the past, you know, year, 18 months, that, you know, like me, you're a big, big fan. And I think that's really important, because although I'm a journalist and a broadcaster, and I have been for more than 40 years, as you say, first and foremost, I'm a fan. Yeah. And I think the day that you stop being a fan is the day that you just stop. You know, when you get been there, seen there, done it, got the T-shirt, just, you know, walk off the field and don't turn back, because there's nothing worse than doing it if it's a chore. And it's never been a chore for me, and I would suspect that it's never been a chore for you either.
Definitely not. I've been doing this for probably 40 years as well, only at a different level, Billy, and I've enjoyed every station that I've been to.
Well, that's the main thing, as long as you enjoy it, because there's nothing worse than getting up in the morning, even if they're paying you £1 million a week, and thinking, I don't want to go in here. You know, you've got to really want to do it, and, you know, that's been all through my career, from the Sunday Mail to the Daily Record to Radio Clyde to Scottish Television to the BBC. It's never seemed like work, you know, it's never seemed like work. It's a kind of extension of your hobby, and that's what's the main thing for me.
Definitely, Billy. Now, you've been on the promotion trail. You did 2 sessions at the Bar Land.
Yeah.
You've been at various other places. How have they all been going?
It's great. We did the first one a few weeks ago. I think it was on the 29th. The book came out on the 28th of September. And then the 29th of September, which was a Friday night, I went to this place called Bernie's Deli Cafe in Bridge of Weir. Now, Bridge of Weir was a place that I'd heard of, but I'd never actually been there. And it was organised by a local bookshop, but they couldn't have the event in the shop because it was too small. So they moved it into this deli cafe. And lo and behold, about 40 or 50 people turned up, and, you know, and I sat and spoke to a lovely girl from the BBC called Laura Maxwell. You know, just she asked me questions about the book and about my career. And at the end of it, we sold all the books. There was something like 40 or 50 books, and we sold everyone. Ali McCoy's turned up. He had been in Rome for the opening of the Ryder Cup. You know, he was covering it for Talk Sport. He's got a successful programme in the morning with Alan Brazil. And he flew straight back from Rome to Edinburgh Airport, jumped in his car, drove from Edinburgh home to Bridge of Weir, because he lives there, dumped his bags, came straight down, and he bought 5 books.
That's
so, you
amazing.
Know, good old Coyster, you know, he bought 5 books. And it was great, you know, it was a kind of new thing for me. You know, somebody asking me the questions as opposed to me asking somebody else the questions. And it was great. We did 2 at the Barland on Sunday there. 12 o'clock and 4 o'clock, and that was really successful. Last Thursday night we did Watson's in Argyle Street, and it was sold out, 70 people, every book sold. Tommy Cunningham from Wet 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 dropped in, it was nice to see him. Paul Buchanan of the Blue Nile, he's been a real supporter, and Jules Gizzy, the guitar player, and Paul McManus from Gunn, they turned up as well. So there was a few faces in the audience, and the people seemed to like it. So I'm on the promo trail. I'm going to the Record Fair in Bella Houston Sports Centre on Saturday afternoon between 12 and 2 to sign some books, if anybody wants to buy one, that is. And then I'm going down to a place called Book Nook in Stewarton, which is a really kind of trendy bookstore. And normally they do the events in the shop, you know, they get maybe 30 or 40 people in, and that's a successful event. But the woman phoned me today and said that as of lunchtime today, she'd sold 106 tickets, and they've moved it to the local village hall. So she's confident that on the night, which is Saturday at 6 o'clock, we're going to have something like 120 people in the local village hall listening to me talking about how the book came about.
Why now? You've been around now for a long, long time, Billy. You've had stories to tell for such a long time. Why did you pick now?
Everybody had always said, you know, friends, family members, you know, guys I met at gigs, you know, colleagues, oh, you should write a book, you've got great stories, you should. And I'm not being falsely modest here, Ronnie, when I say this. I never thought there'd be any interest in a book. I thought, you know, who's going to be interested in, you know, me ranting and raving in the pages of a book? And it dates back to 2012. I was down in London on a job, and if I've got any spare time after the job's finished, I'm a shopper, so I like to have a look around the shops in London. And one of my favourite shops is Selfridges in Oxford Street. And they have a fantastic, and I stress the word fantastic, book department. And I went into the book department in the basement, and you see books in there, particularly those large format Taschen books that you just don't see in any other bookshop the length and breadth of the UK. And I was kind of, I spend hours in there, don't even buy anything half the time, but I spend hours in there. And my favourite bit is the biography section. And I was in there in 2012, and I saw a biography, or maybe even an autobiography, you can tell me, of Pudsey the dog, who won Britain's Got Talent. And I thought, the dog's done it. I need to get my finger out and start writing a book. So I thought, if the dog can do it, I can do it. So I wrote a couple of chapters. I wrote a chapter about we went to London to interview Johnny Cash, and the photographer annoyed him, and he was going to kill us. And I tried to retrieve the situation and only succeeded in annoying him even more. And he was really going to kill us. And then the second chapter I wrote was the night, hand on heart, I supported status quo at the SECC in front of 8,500 people, you know, in Hall 4. You know, they always played a gig on the run-up to Christmas, and I was the support. I did a DJ set, and if I said I died in my backside, it would be an absolute understatement. I mean, I walked off the stage to the sound of my own footsteps, traumatised. I never even waited to see status quo. The production manager said in the office, you know, hang about, you know, you're welcome to hang about and see the Cove with Francis Rossi and Rick Parfitt. And I says, I just want to go up the road. I just want to go home. And I went up the road traumatised. And I wrote those two chapters. But then, as John Lennon said in one of his songs, life is what happens when you're busy making other plans. And, you know, life intervened, and I had family commitments, and I had to, you know, I was a carer for my mother-in-law and that kind of stuff. And you know, I normally write during the night. You know, I'm no good at working from home. So what I tend to do is I start writing at midnight, and I walk right through to about 6 in the morning. There's no phones, there's no telly, there's nobody calling you, there's no nothing like that. But then when I started kind of caring for her, I couldn't do that. I couldn't stay up overnight because I was putting her to her bed at night and getting her up in the morning. So just life intervened. And I never got back round to doing it again until the tail end of last year, when I sent two of the chapters at the request of an agent, and he loved them, stuck them under the noses of a publishing company. They loved them and then said, what else has he got? So suddenly I was having to try and come up with 30 chapters and what they would be about and the structure and that kind of thing. So that's why it took so long.
Do you keep all your interviews all catalogued away where you can get access to them?
I wish I did, you know, when I think of some of the interviews I've done over the years. But, you know, there were so many when I worked for the Daily Record and the Sunday Mail. You would literally interview somebody, some big star, and then the next week you would tape over it and interview another big star. Oh. I've got some of them. I've got a good one with Keith Richards. I've got McCartney. I've got U2. I've got Simple Minds. I think I've got the Associates somewhere. They're on tapes, reel-to-reel tapes and cassette tapes. I wish I'd have kept more of them. I wish I'd even kept a record, because I reckon, as I say in the book, that I must have interviewed, you know, from about 1977 onwards, I must have interviewed well over 1,000 people. But I can remember a lot of what went on and what was said. You know, a lot of it is in print, whether in the pages of the Daily Record and the Sunday Mail, so I can get access to that. But no, I wish I'd kept them. I'm not that organised. I mean, I'm a real collector. I've got every ticket stub, every pass, every autograph, every album that I've ever, you know, collected over the years. But I need to get it into some kind of order. You know, if you came up to the house and said, let me see that such and such, it would take me ages to find it. So at this moment in time, once I get the book commitments out the road, my next thing is to try and get all my memorabilia and all the stuff I've kept and accumulated and get it into some kind of order and decide what am I keeping and what am I not keeping. And I've got some great things. I mean, I've got Prince's waistcoat. I went to see Prince at Wembley Arena in 1986, I think it was. And I was in the front row, and he was dancing on the stage. He had this lovely powder blue suit on with a black waistcoat with white polka dots. And he took it off, and he chucked it into the crowd. And I know you'll find this hard to believe, but like a gazelle, I leapt up and grabbed it out of midair and shoved it up my juke. And it lay in a carrier bag at the top of my wardrobe for something like 20 years. And then I thought, I'm going to do something with this. So I've got pictures of him wearing it. I've got a picture of him actually just about to throw it. I've got the ticket stubs and I got it all framed up. So excellent. I've got that. I've got the Who's first album on the original Brunswick label. We just heard a couple of tracks from the band there. And on the Brunswick label in 1965, My Generation, signed by each of the four of them. John Entwistle, Keith Moon, who are sadly no longer here, Roger Daltrey and Pete Townsend. And what else have I got that's good? I've got all the Simple Mind stuff, all yeah. The U2 stuff. I kept everything. I must have been a squirrel in a past life. I kept everything.
My wife says I'm a kleptomaniac.
Yeah, I'm exactly the same. But, you know, it means something to me, you know. And I've got things that are worth hundreds and thousands of pounds. But, you know, I'm loath to sell them because they mean something to me, you know, so I want to keep hold of them. You know, if I'm ever absolutely destitute, I might try and sort of cash them in, but, you know, I don't want to sell my stuff. I want to keep it. I enjoy it.
My good lady was up in the loft a wee while ago, and she had this clear plastic bag. What's this? It's a towel. What's a towel doing in the loft? It's Mel Gaynor's towel.
There you are.
So it is.
My sister, and I think it was 1971 or something, 72, she waited outside the Albany Hotel in Bothwell Street in Glasgow. That was the main hotel that all the stars stayed in at that point. And she not only got Mark Bolan's autograph, but she got a big, long, ankle-length silk scarf. And he gave her the silk scarf. And not only did he give her the silk scarf, but she could smell his cologne off it. So, I mean, to have Mark. And at that time, he was the biggest thing in the planet, in the whole glam rock thing. And it was a prized possession, as you can imagine, until my late mother, God rest her, was having one of her famous spring cleans. And she went, what's this old manky scarf? And she threw it in the washing machine. And not only did it shrivel up and shrink to about a fifth of its normal size, but it washed out, or, you know, Mark Bolan's cologne. So my sister was going nuts about that. I had all of the Roxy Music, the members of Roxy Music, including Brian Eno, the only time we ever toured with him. And I had all the autographs, and she just thought it was an old bit of paper and threw it out into the bin, and I never ever saw it again. So some things have slipped through the net.
Yeah. My guest tonight here on Pulse 98.4 is Billy Sloan. We're going to be talking about his book, One Love, One Life. But we'll be back shortly after these. It's a Wednesday night here on Pulse 98.4. It is a pleasure to be joined by music journalist and broadcaster Billy Sloan. Billy has his book out, One Love, One Life. I've got that right, haven't I? And it is full of amazing stories. I finished it today, and it is well worth a read. But we played two songs from The Who as we started the show, and there was a reason I'd done that, because your first gig at Green's Playhouse.
And that was the first two songs I've ever heard. You know, I was for somebody who spent 45 years as a music journalist and broadcaster, I was a real kind of late developer. And I never really bought my first record until I was 15. And the reason for that was, we simply didn't have a record player in the house. So I would go to school and all my mates would be talking about albums, and it would be things like Get Your Yayas Out by the Rolling Stones, Split by the Groundhogs, the Yes album by Yes, Babacombe Lee by Fairport Convention, Heartbreaker by Free, you know, stuff like that. You know, The Nice with the Corellia suite with Keith Emerson and that kind of stuff. And they were speaking a foreign language to me. I didn't know what they were talking about. Every Picture Tells a Story by Rod Stewart in 1971. And then my mother, when we moved from Townhead up to Springburn, we moved into this big masonette, which, you know, was like luxury compared to the tenement we'd been in. And she, at some point, went into Arnott's and Simpson's that used to be at the corner of Jamaica Street and Argyle Street, the big department store. And she spent arguably the best 46 quid of her life when she bought what's called a radiogram. Now, a lot of people listening to this won't even know what a radiogram is, but it was like a kind of oblong wooden cabinet with a radio in it. And when you lifted the left-hand lid, there was a turntable which you could play records at 45, 33 or 78 RPM. When you lifted the right-hand lid, that was a sort of cabinet that you could put your records in. And for about 6 months, I only had one record. The first record I ever bought was The Who Live at Leeds. I went away with the Boys Brigade camp to Rhyl in 1971, and I used virtually all of my camp money, my 2 week spending money, buying The Who Live at Leeds and the single Won't Get Fooled Again in the Picture sleeve. And I was kind of bursting to get home to play them. You know, I wasn't bothered about the rest of the holiday. I just wanted to go home to play them. So that was my first record. And then on the 21st of October 1971, The Who played Green's Playhouse. And a few months before that, they put the tickets on sale for the gig. Now, at that point, the Green's Playhouse was primarily a cinema. You went there to go and see movies like, you know, Dr. Zhivago or Gone with the Wind or The Wizard of Oz or whatever the hot movie was at that particular time that they were promoting. And I had to beg my old man, God rest him, and I mean beg him, to let me camp out with my mates in Sucky Hall Street overnight, because for some bizarre reason, and maybe somebody out there can tell us why this is, Green's Playhouse didn't have a box office for the gigs, so all the tickets were sold from an electrical store called House of Clydesdale. So you walked into this little shop. If you come out of Watterson's now and cross the street to where Marks and Spencer's used to be, and it's now closed down, there was a little electrical store there called House of Clydesdale, 170 Sucky Hall Street, and it sold vacuum cleaners, fridges, washing machines, irons, hair dryers, all that kind of stuff. And when you walked through all of that into the back, there was a couple of women that sat at a little table, not unlike those tables that you get if you're pasting wallpaper, if you're decorating your house. And they had books of tickets. So you went, can I get two tickets for The Who? And you gave them your money. They were 85 pence each. And they tore the tickets out of the book and handed them to you. So spin on a few weeks and I go to Green's Playhouse, which of course became the Apollo in 1973. And, you know, on the 21st of October 1971, 85 pence in the stalls, me and my mate. And there they were, 30 feet away from me. Now, up until that point, The Who had just been four guys whose pictures I'd cut out the pages of New Musical Express and Melody Maker and pinned them up on my bedroom wall. Suddenly there they were 30 feet away. And it sounds dramatic to say it, but it was a life-changing moment. I mean, the reason I'm sitting talking to you in 2023, all these years on, is because of that night. I thought, I need to get into music. I would love to have been a swivel-hip rock star, rock god like Robert Plant or even Roger Daltrey. But I kind of knew that I didn't have the talent to be a singer or learn to play an instrument. So I thought, I'm going to try and get in through journalism. And that's what I did. In fact, we had Pete Townsend on my BBC show a few weeks ago because they were re-promoting the new box set of Who's Next from 1971. And I said to him, you know, the whole reason I'm talking to you now is because of that night in, you know, the Green's Playhouse. And he says, well, I'm glad that The Who got you a proper job. So that was it. You know, it's just seeing them up there. They were promoting Who's Next at the time. They did an excerpt from Tommy in the Middle. One of the last songs in the set was the full 7-minute version of Won't Get Fooled Again, with Daltrey sort of marching on the spot and then Keith Moon doing the drum fill and the laser beams going over your head and then Daltrey doing that famous scream, yeah!
Brilliant.
I mean, it was, I'd never seen anything. I'm getting goosebumps just thinking about it. And I've never seen anything like it in my life. And believe you me, that's the reason that, you know, I've had the career I've had and I'm sitting talking to you now. It goes back to that night, 21st of October, 1971, Green's Playhouse, 126 Renfield Street, opposite the Pavilion, 85 pence a ticket. It was a game changer.
I always thought my first gig, Billy, at the Green's Playhouse was Slade.
I was at that. Who was the support?
Status Quo.
I was at that, yeah.
And It was like an almost biblical experience, Billy.
I completely understand what you mean, yeah.
People that you'd only seen on Top of the Pops and things, all of a sudden, they're like 10 foot tall up there on that big stage.
And then I saw them the next time, and the next time I saw them, the supports were an unknown American singer called Susie Quattro.
That's right.
And she just released Can the Can. Then a few months later, it got to number one in the charts. And then second in the bill was Thin Lizzy. And they had just released Whiskey in the Jar. That was their single at the time. And then the next time I saw them, the opening act was another game changer. The sensational Alex Harvey Band. And I just sat up in the balcony and thought, what is this? The next day, I went to Listen Records in Cambridge Street. And I bought the next album simply because of the picture and the cover. And they have remained my all-time favourite Scottish band from that moment on.
I mean, if my memory serves me right, Billy, and sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't, I remember the Slade fans giving Alex Harvey pelters.
Yeah, I mean, I was telling somebody the story a few weeks ago at one of the signings, you know, the lights went down, and in those days, nobody gave a monkey's about who the support act was. The support act could have been the Rolling Stones, the Beatles, or Led Zeppelin, or the Jackson 5, and nobody cared. They just wanted to see the headline band, and I was the same as that. And the lights went down, and this roar went up, and this guy walked on stage, and you could see from the look of him that he was a bit older than your average rock star of the time. He was like a man as opposed to a youth. And he walked on stage with this sort of red velvet smoker's jacket, you know, like somebody with wary if, you know, they were lounging about smoking cigars or something. And he put his foot up in the monitor. And that was like a red rag to a bull. You know, 3,500 people simultaneously. Yeah, 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 yeah. I can't use the language.
No, definitely not.
You can imagine it. Yeah, 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 yeah. And he just stood there and glared at them. And then he took the red velvet smoking jacket off. And he always was ready. Instead of throwing it down, he folded it and laid it down. And then he got a can of McEwan's Pale Ale in the green cans. Remember that? Now, there was no ring pulls then. So you get one of those little sort of metal, you know, things that pierced a triangular hole at either side. But he didn't drink it. He poured it in his hand and he slicked back his hair and he combed his hair back into a kind of DA. And then he went over and he put a leather jacket on. And, of course, he had the black and white striped, you know, horizontal striped T-shirt, which became his trademark. And then he put his foot up in the monitor again. And he had a teacher's cane and he bent the teacher's cane. Now, from the moment he walked on to that point was probably about 90 seconds. Now, that's a long time if you're not really doing anything. Now, by this time, after the 90 seconds, the crescendo of hate that was coming in a big tsunami of noise from the circle and the stalls towards the stage was terrifying, right? And he just kind of waited for a lull in the abuse and he went, "Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, I'd like to introduce you to my band, the sensational Alex Harvey Band." And somebody somewhere pressed a button, I don't know what they're doing, it went, "Do, do, 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 do." And they were into the start of the Faith Healer. Zal Clemenson came on with the green clown Piero outfit and the white face. You know, Chris Glenn came on with a big, you know, blue leather codpiece. You know, Hugh McKenna came on with a sort of floppy hat and the sort of, you know, the dressing gown, smoker's jacket. And Ted McKenna went in with the back of the drum kit. And I just thought, this is one of the greatest. And they get booed on and went down such a storm that they could have got an encore. Yeah. And I remember interviewing Noddy Holder, and he says, "We loved them," he says, "but we had to wait about, you know, 20, 25 minutes delay going on stage to let it try and calm down a bit." And the second time they did that was when they opened for The Who in 1976 at Celtic Park. The Who put the boot into her. And The Who had to delay going on because Alex Harvey had gone down such a storm, they had to let it kind of calm down a wee bit before they went on, and they weren't overshadowed by what had gone before. Incredible stuff. Who else did you see at Green's Playhouse?
Green's Playhouse, oh my goodness. You're talking about, in my house, Billy, money was hard to come by at times. And I saw them support Slade. I saw Sab obviously supporting Slade.
Yeah.
I'm thinking that the Greens, that was it for me.
And did you then go and see people at the Apollo then?
Oh, God, I, yeah.
So who did you see
went
there?
To see bands like America, seen Yes.
The Tales of Topographic Oceans. I was at that.
It was at that one,
yeah. I was at that. I didn't really understand where it was going, but it was
neither great. Did we. Do you know, Billy, I had a hard shift at work that day, and I fell asleep during it.
Wow.
I fell asleep during it. My mates are all going, "Wake up, you, wake up."
Because I got a job in the Greens Playhouse as a steward, so I was, you know, and they gave you this black armband with the white letter steward that you wore on your arm. And I was checked your tickets and half the tickets and showed you to your seat. And I was one of these annoying gits that if, you know, Noddy Holder told you to stand up and dance, I shone a torch in your face and told you to sit down. You told me to get stuffed. But having this armband with Stewart on it was like the Willy Wonka golden ticket. Yes. It got you into all the gigs. So I saw Hawkwind, I saw Status Quo, I saw Rory Gallagher, I saw Genesis with Peter Gabriel, I saw Chuck Berry. Who else did I see? I saw Roxy Music on the first tour, just as For Your Pleasure came out. Who else did I see? I saw Elton John, I saw Hawkwind. So I was in there sometimes 3, 4, 5 nights a week, and you didn't like everybody who was on.
No, of course not.
But it was just the whole excitement, of, you know, because as soon as I went to that gig by The Who, the second one I went to was February of 72, and it was free, and it was only 40 pence to get in. In fact, we had Paul Rogers on the show last week, and I was telling him, and he remembered it. It was 40 pence to get in, and they made a mistake in the ticket. They listed the band's name as The Free, as opposed to Free. I still get my ticket stub. But, you know, I just wanted to be there and soak it all up. You know, I remember seeing Farron Young, the country singer, who had a big hit with a song called It's Four in the Morning. Mm-hmm. Now, that wasn't my kind of music, but just to be there was enough, and it was fantastic. And then, of course, it became the Apollo, and the first Apollo gig I saw, Johnny Cash opened it on the 5th and 6th of August, 73, and then a couple of weeks later, the Stones played two gigs to promote Goat's Head Soup with Mick Taylor in the band, and I saw them, and it was magic. I saw McCartney and Wings at the Greens. Who else did I see at the Apollo? I saw the Bowie shows in 1978, and, of course, we'll probably talk about Bowie later, the Ziggy shows and the Aladdin Sane shows, and who else? I saw Yes. It was great. I just loved it, and I really miss it. It was my favourite venue. It'll always be my favourite venue. And Frank Lynch, the guy who opened it, sadly passed away
just recently, about
2 or 3 weeks ago. And I remember interviewing him in later years, and he said that the only reason he called it the Apollo was because the neon sign letters were £250 each. And Apollo was the shortest and most economical name he could think of because it was only 5 letters. And if he'd have called it the Colosseum, it would have cost a fortune. But he called it the Apollo because at £250 each, it was the shortest name he could think of and the only one he could afford. And the rest is history, as they say.
The Faces gig, that would be the Greens, wouldn't it?
The Faces gig was the Greens, I saw the Faces gig with Ronnie Lane. And then they came back when Ronnie Lane had left it, and it was Tetsu Yamauchi. And I saw that, and I saw, you know, all the early Rod Stewart shows, but the Faces were just
phenomenal.
You know, everybody talks about, you know, Liam and Noel Gallagher being well. They couldn't have lasted a week in the road with the Faces. The Faces were just, I mean, Rod Stewart, you know, as I say in the book, you know, they would have a party at the Albany, and then Ronnie Wood would go, hey, we've got a gig to do. So they would all pile into the limo, and they would go up to Green's Playhouse like an hour late or something. And as Rod said, you know, drunk or sober, we could still play great, and they were fantastic shows, absolutely fantastic.
Billy, how many shows at the Apollo? You go, the support band comes on, and then you had this long gap before the band came on. You're sitting there looking at your watch, you're saying, hope they don't play too long because I'm not going to get my bus home, and I'm not going to get the train home. I don't know what that was.
I don't know what it was. I think a lot of the time it was just to let things calm down. And I mean, I saw some great supports, you know, even though I said nobody was interested. I saw, you know, Mott the Hoople one year, I think it was about 72 or 73, and the support band was a then unknown group called Queen, who I think had just released Keep Yourself Alive as a single, or Liar, I can't remember which. And they come on, and Freddie Mercury had the microphone stand, which looked as if it had been snapped in two. And they were sensational. I mean, I went out the next day up to Listen in Cambridge Street, which was my favourite record store, and I bought Keep Yourself Alive. Who else did I see? I saw Leo Sayer opening for Roxy Music when he came on dressed up with the white face and the clown costume. I saw The Tourists, I think it was, opening for, I think it was Elton John they opened for, and of course led by Dave Stewart and Annie Lennox. Who else? I saw loads of bands, but it was just a great place. I mean, the whole atmosphere of the place, it was falling apart, but it was just the atmosphere. I tell you who I saw, and it was Green's Playhouse in 72. I saw Alice Cooper his first gig in 72 when they were trying to ban him from the country, and Mary Whitehouse, the Morals campaigner, was trying to sort of stop him even setting foot on UK soil. And you'd never seen anything like that before in your life. I mean, the stage set was like an alley in New York, a bit like something that you would see in West Side Story. And there was Alice with a snake, Eva Marie Snake, wrapped around him in the leather and the black eye makeup. And then, of course, they have the knife fight where they sing Gutter Cats versus the Jets from the Killer album. And then, of course, he stabs the guy, so he's got to sort of pay the penalty, and they take him to the gallows and hang him, and he's hanging there in the gallows. You'd never seen anything like that in your life before. Then the stage went to black, and a few seconds later he came back on with a white tail coat and a white top hat and a cane and sung Elected. It was mind-blowing, Billy, absolutely mind-blowing.
I think that is one of those Greens Playhouse gigs that if you asked everybody, were you there, you could have filled it 10 times.
Yeah, absolutely.
Over.
And the tickets were 90 pence because I had a ticket. I didn't really know that much about Alice Cooper. And this guy who worked in the oil rigs, and you know those guys always had pots of money. You know, they always made 10 times more than anybody else. They did 3 weeks on and 2 weeks off. And he offered me £7.50 for my ticket. And I sold it because for £7.50, I could buy three albums at £2 each and a single at 50 pence. And listen, so I sold my ticket. But then we went round the side and a guy managed to pull the door open. And we all ran in, so I got to see the gig for free, and I get £7.50 to go and buy three albums and a single.
In the book, Billy, you tell people how you queued up at Listen Records on Cambridge Street to buy Aladdin Sane.
Yeah.
And you were there at the ceremony, opening of the box, and the guy held it up.
Aye.
I was in the queue a bit further round.
Oh, were you? Great. Well, I mean, the guy was late in arriving, and then he kind of staggered into the shop, which was tiny in Cambridge Street. And, he put the box down the counter, and the guy got a standing knife and kind of split the ceiling tape, opened it up, and he brought this thing out. And as I say in the book, he held it up almost like a midwife in a maternity unit, showing everybody this lovely new bouncing baby that she'd just delivered. And, you know, you'd never seen anything like it. There was David Bowie with this red and blue thunderflash down the middle of his face and the red hair. And I bought it on the strength of the cover. I mean, I'd been a David Bowie fan, obviously. I'd Hunky Dory and Ziggy Stardust before that. And I went straight home, put the needle in the first track, which I think is what? Watch That Man. And just that there. And, you know, I did what you probably did. You would play side one, turn it over, play side two, turn it over, play side one, turn it over. So I was able to play it about four times before my mother and father came in from work and my brother and sister came back from school. And it was like, you know, I used to sit and hold the record, you hold the album to my chest, almost like you were kind of embracing it.
Yeah.
Because it's always been a really tactile thing for me, and I would be following the lyric sheet and looking to see who the engineer was and where it had been recorded. And, it was a real connection. And you know, kids these days, you know, I've got my two oldest granddaughters, I think, are 26 and 22. You know, they don't even own a CD, let alone a vinyl record, you know. And, you know, when you talk about 12-inch singles or albums, they look at you, they don't know what you're talking about. And while kids, you know, you're three clicks of a mouse away from the most obscure record you can think of, and, you know, there are obvious advantages to be able to store 10,000 of your favourite songs in a little phone that you can put in your pocket or a tablet that you could carry in your bag or something. You know, they're getting a different experience from what we got, and it just isn't as sexy downloading an album in a faceless computer file. You know, if it's a choice between doing that or going in and getting a great record with great artwork, with a gatefold sleeve and, you know, the lyric sheet, you know, and I bought the first five Roxy Music albums without hearing a note of music.
Yeah.
I bought Kimono My House by Sparks. I bought The Psychomodo by Cockney Rebel. I bought Next by the sensational Alex Harvey Band. All in the strength of what the cover looked like.
Yeah.
You know, the fact that the record was fantastic and it was full of great songs was like, you know, the Brucey bonus. I bought them because they just looked, the Roxy Music albums just looked amazing. And, you know, when you think of an album like For Your Pleasure, where Brian Ferry was dressed up as a chauffeur and he had a Black Panther on a lead, standing, leaning up against a big limo, and Amanda Lear was kind of standing there, you know, looking amazing. It's almost as famous now as any of the songs in For Your Pleasure. And, you know, kids these days, they're getting an experience, but it's a very different experience. And I personally don't think it's as fulfilling an experience.
I will take our experience over anything now. Billy, we're going into a break again, and we'll come out of that. We'll hear the title track from David Bowie's Aladdin Sane. David Bowie, the title track from his 1973 album, Aladdin Sane. And I'm joined in the studio with a music journalist and broadcaster, Billy Sloan. Now, Billy, we both loved that album.
Yeah.
And I think what I loved about it, probably even more than Ziggy, was Mike Garson's keyboards all the way
through.
Yeah,
I mean, you know, Mike Garson, for people who don't know, was this kind of jazz-based piano player from America. And the story goes that when Bowie asked him to come into the studio, you know, and play a piano solo on the title track of the album, he played this solo, and Bowie didn't like it. And then he played another solo, and Bowie didn't like it. And then he played a third solo, and Bowie said, you know, I thought you were kind of avant-garde, you know, jazz-influenced piano player. He says, I am. He says, but I didn't think that's what you want. He said, no, just do that. And what you just heard there was the fourth solo that he played, and it's a straight take. He played it, and Bowie said, that's exactly what I'm looking for. And Mike Garson, I think, is the musician who ended up playing more gigs and playing on more records than anybody else in the whole Bowie kind of, you know, circle of friends and musicians, you know. So he played with him right up until his death. In fact, he played a gig a few years ago at the ABC where they recreated, you know, a couple of the Bowie albums with Glenn Gregory of Heaven 17 doing the vocals, and Woody Woodmansey was playing drums. And I got talking to him, and he was a great guy. And, you know, I'm a huge fan, as I know you are, of David Bowie. I don't think he's really made a bad record, to be honest.
He certainly hasn't. Of course, we lost David.
2016.
My phone went at 6:45 in the morning and answered it, bleary-eyed. And it was my late pal, Alec. He said, Ronnie, sorry to phone you so late, but it's just came over. And, of course, it was one of those mornings. I just went back to my bed, and Mary's going, What was that all about?
Yeah.
I said, that was Alec. What's he doing on the phone? I said, David Bowie's dead.
I was exactly the same. And I mean, the thing, you know, if you remember, you know, as I say in the book, you know, did Bowie obviously was very ill, and he made his last record, you know, under a real kind of veil of secrecy, and all the people and all the friends and producer Tony Visconti who worked in it, they were all sort of sworn to secrecy and not to reveal the fact that he was suffering badly from cancer. And I say, you know, was his final artistic act the fact that he choreographed his own death? Because, you know, the album came out, and then a couple of days later he passed away. And, of course, the single Lazarus, you know, where he's, you know, lying in the bed, you know, with the bandages around his eyes, and then the final scene where he goes back into the wardrobe and he pulls the door closed with a finger. It was maybe about 6 or 9 months before I could watch it. I just couldn't bring myself to watch it. And what an artistic statement it is. I mean, you know, I was lucky enough that I saw him very early on. I saw him in January of 1973 when he was touring to promote Ziggy Stardust. And then it was Green's Playhouse. And then by that time I was working there. And in May of 73... his popularity was soaring so much that he agreed to do a 6:30 matinee and then a 9 o'clock evening show. So I was working as a steward there, and I was sent down to the stage door of Green's Playhouse and was told, you know, to help out when the artist arrived. And suddenly the door burst open and David Bowie literally landed in my arms. You know, he had the red Ziggy haircut, he had the black and white sort of checkerboard, you know, jumper that he wore quite a lot when he was travelling. And I had to escort him down to the dressing room. Now, at that time, the dressing room in the Green's Playhouse was underneath the stage. It was this kind of very dark, damp, almost like coal cellar. But when you walked in, there were all the Ziggy costumes and the Aladdin Sane costumes hanging up in coat hangers in the walls. So you had the big cape, the big silk cape, and you had that woolen kind of bodice thing, which had the one leg and the one arm. And then my favourite is the little sort of almost like a leotard with the woodland creatures on it, you know, all designed by the Japanese designer Yamamoto. And, you know, unfortunately, we didn't have camera phones those days, but had I had a camera phone, I would have got a picture of Ziggy Stardust. So that was May of 1973, and then a few weeks later, he played Hammersmith Odeon and said to the audience, this show will remain with us the longest because not only is it the last show of the tour, but it's the last show that we'll ever do, and he killed off Ziggy Stardust.
He didn't tell the band.
The only person that knew apparently was Mick Ronson. Everybody's looking at one another going, what was that? Are we hearing things? And then, you know, so that was May of 1973 that I saw him in the Green Sleeve House twice. And then in 1983, 10 years later, I was sitting in the dressing room at Murrayfield in Edinburgh on the Serious Moonlight tour when he just released Let's Dance, which was his most commercial selling record, and I'm sitting interviewing him. He had this kind of blonde Princess Diana kind of hair, the blue suit, the braces, the shirt. And I was lucky enough over the years, I interviewed him 7 times, 6 times face to face, and the last time I interviewed him was in 2003 on the phone. And then after that, I interviewed him at the SEC in November of 2003, because he was going to be headlining Tea in the Park the following summer, 2004. And then, of course, he'd had a heart attack and he cut back in all his live appearances, and then suddenly he never really appeared live anywhere after that.
I mean, we were blessed with what a class, a couple of really good albums. The next day, that really took us all by surprise.
Absolutely incredible, you know. But this was a guy, and when you see him in those videos and the photos, you know, you now know with the benefit of hindsight that this was a guy who was ill, and he would go to the studio some day, and some days he was able to put a shift in, but other days, you know, he wasn't. But when you see the Lazarus video and stuff like that, you know, he just looked... I mean, when you see that sequence in it where he's sitting at the desk writing and he's kind of going right off the page and around the side of the desk, you know, he looked no well, for want of a better term. And, you know, when I interviewed him on the phone when Reality came out, and, you know, Reality, the lyrics of the songs are kind of peppered with references to his adopted home of New York, because he lived in a street called Lafayette Street in the Soho area of New York and Manhattan, which is one of my favourite areas. And he lived there with a man and his toddler of a daughter at the time, Alexandria. And I says, you know, how did you feel when, you know, your new home came under attack in 9/11? You know, what was your reaction? And he said that they bought the house in Lafayette Street, and one of the selling points of the house was that his kitchen window looked straight into the Twin Towers. So if he was standing making a cup of tea, he could look into the Twin Towers. And on the morning of 9/11, he wasn't there. He was upstate New York in a recording studio working on songs for the next album. I can't remember what it was. And he phoned a man, or she phoned him, and said, I'm standing at the window, a plane's going into the North Tower, or whatever it was. And then she says, a plane's going into the South Tower. And he just says, get the baby, get some clothes, get the buggy, and get out of there. You're under attack. And, you know, it was a terrifying moment. And then, you know, he bought the house for something like $4 million, which is a significant sum of money. And then a couple of years ago, it was sold for $16.5 million. And when you saw the pictures on Facebook, you know how the estate agents put the pictures up, you know, for prospective buyers, it just looked amazing, absolutely amazing. But, you know, I was lucky enough to interview him, as I say, 7 times. And I built up a little bit of a relationship with him. You know, when he came to Scotland, I was always the guy that he spoke to. And I've got loads of stuff signed. And he was really, really very gracious towards me. So, you know, as well as being a fan, I'm a real admirer of the guy as a guy, because he really was, you know, very gracious to me.
I was at that. Ziggy gig. I was at the matinee.
Oh, were you? Wow!
My dad had queued up kindly. I mean, my dad would never have done anything like that, but he was going into town in the morning. The tickets were going on sale, so he went in early, queued up, and he was literally a couple of feet away when it came out and they were sold out. Then they gave out the other tickets.
Right.
There might be a chance of a matinee.
Yeah.
And thankfully my dad stuck around and got me a ticket.
I mean, you know, you think kids now these days, you know, they all shout and scream and moan and groan because, you know, they're trying to get Taylor Swift tickets, and, you know, the tickets go on sale at 9 o'clock, and then 20 seconds past nine, it's completely sold out. I don't know how you get tickets like that. But there was something really kind of, it was much more fun queuing out overnight in sleeping bags and freezing conditions. And, you know, kids these days would think, what are you talking about, right? But, you know, I did that loads of times. I did it for the Stones. There was a great time, which I mentioned in the book, with the Stones. I can't remember what year it was. It's in the book. But we got a tip off that, you know, they were putting the tickets on sale this Wednesday at 12 noon. So at a minute to 12, the guy from the Apollo came out with a handwritten, it was like a piece of paper torn out of a notebook, with a handwritten piece of paper, an A4 size paper. And it said, Rolling Stones in concert, tickets on sale now, £6 or something. And he sellotaped it to the glass door of the Apollo. And that was happening in theatres all over the country where they were appearing, Hammersmith Odeon and Manchester Apollo and that kind of stuff. And then, of course, they put it out in Radio Clyde News, and suddenly there was folk arriving, you know, in taxis and helicopters, you know, flying in, you know, in jetpacks and that. And within half an hour, there was a queue running into Sucky Hall Street, but we had been tipped off, and when the guy pinned it up, me and my mates were maybe within the first 20 people that went in, and it was only two tickets each. I think they were doing three nights or something. So we came out, waited a couple of minutes, all changed jackets, and went back into another window and got another four tickets, and then came back out, went to another girl. It was great, you know, things like that just made the whole anticipation of what you were going to see all that more kind of potent. And that Disney, I mean, the other thing that drives me around the bend, and I'm sure it does with you as well, when you buy a ticket now, you know, if you buy a ticket for the Hydro or the Barland or whatever it is, it's just a sort of computer printout thing with the date and the band's name on it and the promoter and the price and that. I've got great tickets for Tina Turner, Rod Stewart, Dire Straits, Elton John, which are works of art, you know, big long tickets. And, you know, you just don't get that anymore, you know. And then the other thing that drives me mental is you go to a gig at the Hydro, which I love, I have to say, but, you know, it's not even a ticket, it's a barcode in your phone, and you know, you don't even get a ticket, or you know, you've got to print out something and they scan a barcode. You know, bring back tickets. I want a ticket.
The ticket was always a big thing,
yeah,
Billy.
Absolutely.
You would maybe buy it a couple of weeks before the gig, you would maybe buy it months before the gig, and you had to make sure that ticket was away nice and safe.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, with the ticket for the Who, the gig we talked about earlier, you know, I get up the road and I put it in an envelope and I put it between two t-shirts in my drawer. And I went in two, three times a day, something just to make sure it was still there and it was flat and it hadn't been folded. And it was almost like a kid saying to their parents, you know, how many sleeps to Santa?
Right. That's exactly what it was.
And then, you know, on the day that you actually took it out to go and use it and you get it torn in half at the Greens Playhouse or the Apollo, and one half said to be retained and the other half said to be given up. And I've got, you know, virtually every ticket stub from every gig I've ever been at, and you know, and I need to get them in some kind of order because they're all lying in boxes and stuff, but I must have thousands of ticket stubs.
Billy, we're now at a certain age. When we got our first gig tickets, on the day, my heart would be racing.
Yeah.
It would be full of anticipation. Do you still get that feeling these days?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, I did an interview with a guy from the Herald, a lovely guy called Teddy Jameson, and he wrote this great piece which he just got me, and there was a couple of really funny bits in it which made me laugh out loud. It was great. And I think he interviewed me when I turned 60, which was 7 years ago, and he went, I mean, now that you're 60, you know, you're not going to be going to King Tut's and going to all these gigs. And I was like, you know, why would I not do that? You know, just as if you were 16, you're supposed to go into some kind of retirement. But, you know, I'm a bit Woody Allen when it comes to gigs and stuff. You know, I like to be in at the start of the gig. I don't like to miss a start, and I like to watch the middle, and I like to stay right to the very end.
Yeah.
So I'm a bit Woody Allen neurotic when it comes to that. And, you know, I still get excited. You know, I went to see The Who at Edinburgh Castle at the start of July. And, you know, it was magnificent. Absolutely. I just loved every single minute of it. And, you know, as I said earlier, you know, when you get to being there, seen it, done it, got the T-shirt, you know, and you start yawning, just don't go. Just, you know, let somebody else have the ticket that's going to be excited by it. Because I enthuse. I know that you enthuse as well. I can tell that you enthuse. That's why I'm here. And, you know, people that don't enthuse, I just don't have any time for, you know, because, you know, I want to sort of talk music with people like you, like-minded people, because I know that when I tell you all this stuff, you know exactly what I'm talking about. And I know that when you tell me all your stuff, you have hit the target. So, you know, that's why I'm delighted to be sitting here at Pulse 98.4.
It was great that you got to see The Who at Edinburgh Castle with the orchestra. I have a friend, Willie. Willie turned 70 last year. And he didn't know where he was going to go. He'd never missed a Who gig.
Yeah.
He'd seen them all the time in Glasgow. he was a bit peed off that they decided Edinburgh, and I kept saying to him, Willie, you have to go to this gig. Yeah. This is your band. Anyway, I got a text on the day. I've got a ticket. I'm going. And the rain stayed off, as you well know.
Well, the first day was pelting rain, because we went through and did an interview with him.
The second day.
And the second day, which was the Sunday, because I couldn't go on the first day because it was Saturday and I was working. And it was bouncing, the rain was bouncing, but it was the second day. But, you know, and we're getting to a sort of period in our life now where, you know, Dylan's in his 80s, McCartney's in his 80s, Mick Jagger's just turned 80, Townsend's 78. So, you know, you're getting to a stage where all these guys like Brian Wilson, Ray Davies, you know, Neil Diamond, Paul Simon, you know, they're not going to go on forever. And I just think that, you know, we went to see The Who, and you're thinking that this could be the last day. I mean, last summer I went down to Anfield in Liverpool, the home of Liverpool FC, which I'd never been to before. And we went to see The Stones on their tour. And it was the first time, of course, they toured without Charlie Watts, God rest him. And I went down with a couple of mates of mine. One's a guy called Raymond Mead, who plays the bass with Ocean Colour Scene. Yeah. And he is a Rolling Stones obsessive, you know, particularly Keith Richards. He could quite literally go on Mastermind with Keith Richards, his specialist subject, and he would get a great mark. And I also went with another pal of mine, a guy called Jules Gizzy, who plays guitar with Gunn. And of course, way back in 1990, Gunn supported the Rolling Stones on the bigger, it wasn't his Steel Wheels, it was, what was the tour? It was Steel Wheels, whatever the European name for that was called. And so they actually did 26 gigs with the Stones. They started in Rotterdam and Holland, went right through Europe and ended up at Hampden Park in Glasgow. So I was there with two real fans, and I'm a real fan myself. And they came on stage, you know, and the first number was Street Fighting Man. And Mick Jagger really led from the front, you know, at that point he was 79 years of age or something like that. And I kind of got the goosebumps as soon as they came on and went into the song. But then I also kind of got a wee bit emotional. And my eyes started filling up a bit because I thought, this could maybe be the last time we're ever going to see this. You know, they're not going to go on forever. This might be quite literally the last time. So we watched the show and we were going straight back. We had a driver and we were going straight back to Glasgow as soon as the show finished. So we never get back to like 3 o'clock in the morning or something. And as we were walking down and comparing notes, Jules and Raymond, they both admitted that they had felt exactly the same, but Jules had turned away because he didn't want me to see him getting emotional. And I think that's the power of music, you know, when it has that kind of effect on you. Because, you know, for as long as I've been buying records and going to gigs, I've been buying Rolling Stones records and going to Rolling Stones gigs, but there's going to be a time, realistically, and is it 5 years? Is it Mick Jagger's not going to be touring and dancing about the stage when he's 90 years of age?
No, definitely
McCartney's 81. I think he's touring Australia at the moment. He's not going to go on forever. And there's going to be a time when we're not going to be able to do that. And I just, like you said a moment ago, just take real comfort from the fact that we lived in an era where, you know, the guys were the soundtrack to our life. Bowie, you know, the Stones, the Beatles, you know, McCartney, the Kinks, you know, all that kind of stuff, you know, because with the best will in the world, you're left with Sam Smith and Kasabian and Ed Sheeran, and
there's not a lot you can say after that, Billy.
There's not a lot you can say after that. You know, it's kind of, I always say, you know, good luck to Ed Sheeran. He's the highest grossing touring act in the world at the moment, or they was the last time they counted. And I'm sure he's a lovely man. The music just kind of leaves me cold. And I always say that Ed Sheeran's best song isn't he as good as Brian Wilson or Ray Davies' worst song?
Yeah.
And I firmly believe that. I think a lot of the craft that's, you know, made great records like, you know, Sgt. Pepper's or Pet Sounds or Ziggy Stardust or Sticky Fingers just doesn't exist any longer. And then, of course, they're talking about all this AI thing, you know, where you put all the ingredients of a Beatles, you know, track into, you know, the blender, and you press, you know, you blend it all together and a Beatles-sounding song comes out. I mean, I was interviewing Noel Gallagher recently and somebody had made an indie band from down south had made an Oasis record where they'd got all the elements that would make the perfect Oasis song. And, you know, they got a guy who sounded a bit, and I stress the word a bit, like Liam Gallagher. And I said to Noel Gallagher, what do you think? He says, another beep indie band with another beep album. And I think you can fill in the beeps or not. Yeah. And somebody else was talking. I think it was, it might even have been Bernie Taupin on Graham Norton.
That's right.
I saw something recently. Yeah. And he said, you know, you're not going to get the emotion and you're not going to get the, you know, the sort of, you know, coming from the heart if you get this AI thing. You know, I mean, nothing. I can't think of anything worse. You know, if you've got Paul McCartney writing a Paul McCartney song, or some guy giving you what a Paul McCartney song might sound like if it comes out of a computer, I'll take the Paul McCartney song.
Oh, definitely, definitely. We'll go into a break. You mentioned the Gun Boys there. Absolutely love the guys. I've chatted to them many times on the show, and we'll come out of the break. We'll have better days. That's Gun there, Better Days. This is Pulse 98.4 on a Wednesday night. I'm Ronnie McGee, and it's an absolute pleasure to be joined in the studio from a music journalist and broadcaster. He's been doing that for 45 years. Billy, does it feel like 45 years?
No, it's just kind of whizzed by, and 99.9% of it has been very enjoyable. So, you know, I'm not planning to give up anytime soon. You know, I've now got what's left of my hair's turned white. You know, I'm going to be 68 on my next birthday, which is in December. But, you know, age is just a number. You know, I still love records. I still love going to gigs. I still love interviewing, you know, my favourite rock stars. So if I can squeeze another few years out of it and still do it with equal enthusiasm, which I'm sure I will, I'm going to carry on doing it.
I turned 66 in September.
Age
there.
Is only a number.
No,
man.
It is only a number.
It's only a number.
Only a number. And a bit more money in the bank account.
Yeah, it's only a number.
My wife says to me.
I actually got my bus pass when I was 60, and I made a statement, right? I used my bus pass for the first time when I get the bus from the west end of Glasgow into town, and I went to see Cooler Shaker at the ABC, and then I used my bus pass to get back up the road. So I fought the punk rock war, so I was making a statement using my bus pass for the very first time to go and see Cooler Shaker.
Now, Billy, they say every day is a school day.
Yeah.
And reading your book, I got a revelation. I used to read your column in the Sunday Mail all the time. I had no idea you were the disco kid.
Yeah, I was the disco kid. I was that soldier. You know, I was asked to do the pop page because the guy who they had a couple of kind of middle-aged stringers that would supply sort of information from London, and then some sub-editor in the Sunday Mail who didn't know anything about music would kind of knock it into shape, and they thought, you know, we need to try and get somebody who knows what they're doing and would go to gigs and would buy records and would know the difference between, you know, Simple Minds or, you know, the Bay City Rollers or whatever. So I get drafted in to do it. And, you know, I did my first column, I think it was in September of 1979. And I just assumed that they would put, you know, Pop Page by Billy Sloan, because, you know, the football column was the football column by Alan Herron, who was the chief football writer. And the Showbiz column was done by a great guy called Scott Robinson, who was really funny, you know, and he had a great column. So I had gone to, the day before the first column came out, I had gone to the Edinburgh Rock Festival at Ingilson. And the bill comprised of Van Morrison, Talking Heads, The Undertones, I think it was Steel Pulse or Squeeze, The Valves, a few local bands. And they phoned my house, and this was pre-mobile phone, so, you know, the deputy editor phoned my house and says, is Billy there? No, he's away to the Edinburgh Rock Festival. He's not going to be back until 1 or 2 in the morning. So they had no way of getting in touch with me. So they just had to invent a name for the column. So, of course, I came back from the gig and I go to the guy who sells the papers outside Central Station at, you know, 1 in the morning, and I buy a copy of the Sunday Mail. And what should have been a proud moment, I left my mate and I went over to a shop doorway and I opened it up at the page that the column was on. And it said, the pop gossip by the disco kid. And I thought, who's that? That's me. And I thought, oh my God. So I phoned the editor, the deputy editor up on the Sunday afternoon. I said, look, you need to get rid of this. This sounds ridiculous. It's a terrible pun. We're trying to get some credibility for your music page. You know, this sounds like some kind of cartoon character. But of course, he made the point, oh, we've just launched the disco kid. We can't kill him off after 7 days. So I was stuck with it. And I thought, well, at least it'll be, you know, fairly anonymous. So I thought, when I walked into my local pub on the Monday for a game of pool with my mates, you know, the first wise guy said to me, Go for your gun, Disco. And then another joker said, I hope you've not tied your horse up outside the saloon in a double yellow line and you're going to get a ticket. And then when I went for a pee, they all started whistling, you know, the theme song for A Fistful of Dollars. Doodly-loo, doo-doo-doo. I thought, oh my God. So I was the Disco Kid anonymously for about 18 months, and then they decided to unmask me. And I thought, oh God. But actually having your picture and your own name at the top of the page proved to be a blessing in disguise, because people could kind of identify with you, and yep. Guys would come up at gigs and talk to you, and they would hand you demos and that kind of stuff. So it was a bit of a blessing in disguise, and I did that. I did it for 79 right through to 83, and then I got a staff job working at the Daily Record in 1983, and I worked right through there until, 1994, and then I rejoined the Sunday Mail, and I was there ever since. So, you know, I was there for 33 years in total, and as I say, most of the time it was great. You know, you still had, you know, middle-aged newspaper executives try to get you right about some god-awful band that their daughters loved or something. So you always get that all the way through, but it was pretty enjoyable, and I got to travel the world, and I got to rub shoulders with some of the biggest stars in the world. So, you know, it was fantastic. It was brilliant.
Did it come with pressure, Billy?
Yeah, because when you were at the Sunday Mail, you know, you had all week to kind of think about what you were going to write. But as soon as I joined the Daily Record in 1983, it was Valentine's Day, February the 14th, 1983. And as I say in the book, there was not a lot of love from a few quarters, because while the paper had a football correspondent, a political correspondent, a medical correspondent, an industrial correspondent, a car correspondent, a fashion correspondent, they didn't have a music correspondent, a TV correspondent, they didn't have a music correspondent until I was hired. And a lot of the old timers in the back bench, you know, they kind of looked down their noses at me because I was writing about guys with long hair and guitars. But, you know, The Sun had just launched a few months previously, the Bizarre column, right, which still runs to this day, and it was written by a guy called John Blake, who was a good operator. And then you had Rick Sky in the Mirror, who was a great guy, Baz Bammingboy in the Daily Mail, Leslie Ann Jones in the Mail on Sunday, Jeff Baker in the Star, and then a great old-timer called David Wick, who did the Daily Express. So all these papers in Fleet Street had a dedicated music writer. And I was billed by the record editor, who was a great guy called Bernie Vickers. He billed me as Scotland's number one pop writer right from the word go. So the heat was on. He would have been more accurate billing me as Scotland's only pop writer, because none of the other papers had a pop writer. And there was a lot of pressure, because, as I say, you were working in one story a week for the Sunday Mail, and you kind of all week to think about it. But the Daily Record had six editions, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday. So you were working in two or three or four stories at the same time. So it was the kind of journalistic equivalent of spinning plates. And the other significant thing with Bernie was a Mancunian. He was a real kind of old school newspaper man who was very, very well thought of, you know, in newspaper circles, not only in Scotland, but all over the UK. And he decided that, you know, he wanted our guy to sort of lead the charge. And what happened was, you know, when you pick up a paper these days and you see somebody who's done an exclusive interview with Madonna, you pluck a name out there, you've got to ask yourself this question. And the question is, did that guy sit in a room the way I am with you, yep, 3 feet away from you, and ask Madonna questions and write the interview up? I think you would be amazed to find out that in a large percentage of those times, he wasn't even in the same country as Madonna, let alone the same room, because you would get press releases sent through from PR people with quotes on it, and now we're in the age of the internet where you can go into, you know, Google and type in Madonna's name and all this information, or should it be misinformation?
Yeah.
So in the early 80s, when I started in 83, you know, somebody like Paul McCartney or David Bowie or Mick Jagger had a kind of protective cocoon around them, which was managers, personal assistants, publicists, security people, record company promo people. So it was kind of hard to get to a lot of these guys. So Bernard decided that he wanted, if I went to interview an artist of that stature, he wanted me to get a photograph with him. Yeah. Because he was trying to prove that while you couldn't get near Mick Jagger or Paul McCartney or David Bowie, our guy could.
Yeah.
So that was why I had a picture of me standing next to Mick Jagger or David Bowie or Paul McCartney. And also from a selfish point of view, I thought, you know, you might only get one chance in your life. Luckily with McCartney it's been four times, and with Jagger it's been three times. You might only get one chance in your life to be in a room with Paul McCartney or Bruce Springsteen or Tina Turner or Paul Simon or Dolly Parton or Ray Davies of the Kinks or Brian Wilson of the Beach Boys, you would be insane not to have some kind of record of it. So that's why I used to say, you know, can we get a picture taken? And I've got a great collection of all these pictures, some of which are in the book. And I would also ask for an autograph, because the London guys would never do that, because they thought that they were too cool for school, and they thought that they were bigger stars than the stars they were interviewing. So they would never ask for an autograph. But I would also say, can you sign that? Who's it for? Expecting them to say, me to say, it's for my next-door neighbour's paperboy's girlfriend's pal. I would say, no, it's for me. And they were quite surprised at that, but I never made any bones about it that I was a fan and that I wanted them to sign my album. And I've got all that stuff. I kept all that stuff in the house. And, you know, I've still got it. And it means a lot to me. I can remember every single time, you know, the thing was signed and where it was signed and how it was signed. So, you know, that was why we started the whole me with my arm around a pop star kind of thing.
Brilliant. We'll play another track now from another of both Billy and I's favourite Glasgow bands, the Blue Nile. This is Stay. It's Pulse 98.4 on a Wednesday night. 9:45, Billy Sloan, where does the time go?
I've no idea. I thought we'd just been talking for 5 or 10 minutes.
That was Stay by the Blue Nile. Now, Billy, I've got a couple of listener questions for you. Quick fire. Colin from Paisley, what's your favourite Glasgow venue?
My favourite Glasgow venue was the Greens Playhouse / the Apollo. As that no longer exists, I think the Barland has become a real natural successor. I love the Hydro as well, but, you know, if you put me on the spot and said, what's your favourite venue to go to a gig, it would be the Barland. I've seen some magical things there, REM, U2, Simple Minds, The Skids, the Beastie Boys. I've seen a whole load of bands there, and I think it's fabulous.
What an atmosphere in the place.
Oh, it's great. I love it. Absolutely love it.
Elizabeth Brown from Barhead. I know Billy's been at so many gigs, but is there one that stands out?
If you put me on the spot and said, what's your favourite gig, you know, of all the hundreds or maybe thousands of gigs I've been to over the years, it would be the early 90s. I think it was 92 or 93, the Zoo TV shows at Celtic Park when U2 played a couple of shows back to back, and they had the satellite link way, a bomb shelter in, you know, Sarajevo. And there was a woman who was in the bomb shelter, and she was able to send a message to her son who'd escaped the fighting, and he was actually in the crowd at Celtic Park that night. And after the gig, you know, I went into the dressing room to see the guys, because I've had a good relationship with U2 since 1981 when I interviewed Bono for the first time in the gents' toilet in level 5 of Strathclyde University, simply because it was the only place quiet and echoey enough that we could do a radio interview. And I took my son in to see Bono, and he was 15 at the time, and, you know, can I meet Bono? Can I meet Bono? And Bono's a great guy. I love the guy. He's a gentleman, and he's written a lovely message for the book. And we got a picture taken, and Bono, for the purposes of the picture, took his fly sunglasses off and put them on my son Paul, so we got the picture taken. So Paul took the glasses off and handed them back to Bono, and Bono said, no, they look better on you than they do on me. You keep them. And that's the kind of guy he is. I mean, they're in the sphere in Las Vegas, you know, at the start of a 25-date residency in this incredible new multi-billion-dollar venue. And they've been locked away before that. You know, it started on the 29th of September. They've been locked away before that in a soundstage for like 6-8 weeks, you know, rehearsing, because they're playing Achtung Baby in its entirety. But he still found 10 minutes
Fantastic.
To come out and write a little message for the book, you know, and I take my hat off to him. He's a lovely, lovely man.
A regular listener to both our shows, Laurel from Glasgow, what is the one band or artist you would have loved to have seen but never got to?
Well, the Beatles. I'd love to have seen the Beatles, you know, on the Apple Roof. But I think if you put me on the spot, it would be Elvis in the Vegas years when he was playing on the Strip, you know, 70, 71, 72, you know, with the jumpsuits and the karate kicks. And you know, I've seen the two movies, you know, Elvis on tour, and That's the Way It Is. And I would love to have seen Elvis at the peak of his powers in Las Vegas. I'd also love to have seen the Small Faces, Dusty Springfield, the Walker Brothers. You know, who else would I love to have seen? I'd love to have seen the Beatles, obviously, that goes without saying. But if you put me on the spot, it would be Elvis in the Vegas years. I'd love to have seen that.
Now, Billy, radio was probably a natural progression for you. And when did you start at Clyde?
I started in Clyde, I think it was 79. You know, I'd worked for a newspaper that they had out called Clyde Guide, and it kind of lasted for a year, and then it went down the tubes. But the good thing was it got me a foot in the door at Clyde. And Doogie Donnelly used to do this great show on a Friday night called the Boozy Woogie Rock Show. Steve Jones did it first. Aye. And then Doogie did it, and it was a great show. You know, they had guests like Nazareth and Elvis Costello and whoever was visiting, playing the Apollo. And Doogie was doing a lot of sort of TV stuff at that time for the BBC, you know, as a sports broadcaster. And he was taking like a 6 week period off to go and do something for the BBC. And instead of getting somebody to fill in for 6 weeks, they got a guest presenter to fill in each week. There were six different people. I was one. Tom Russell was another one. And, you know, I did it, and I didn't know anything about presenting a radio programme. I thought I knew what I was doing, and, you know, I was probably umming and ahhing all the way through a two-hour show, but I played some great records, and the boss was a guy called Andy Parr, and he loved it and said, look, you know, why don't you come in? And he used to do a show on a Thursday night between midnight and two in the morning, and his workload was just getting so much that he just couldn't do everything. So he said, you know, why don't you do midnight to two on a Thursday night? And it started off being just kind of themes, you know, what's your favourite live album, what's your favourite song from the movies. And then slowly but surely I managed to sort of ditch all that, and I was playing U2, The Associates, Simple Minds, Altered Images, The Skids, Susie and the Banshees, all that kind of stuff, which was just not getting played anywhere in Scotland. You know, if you wanted to listen to that stuff, you listened to John Peel, obviously, but there was nobody in Scotland that was playing that. And I, you know, never had any experience. I just sat there like you do and played my favourite records and thought, well, if I like these records, maybe somebody else will like them. You know, everybody used to think I was sitting like some kind of rock and roll Mystic Meg with a crystal ball saying, you know, I'm going to make this band stars and all that. It was nothing like that. I just thought, this is a good record. I quite like it. Maybe somebody else will like it. And the feedback was great because for a long time it was a kind of one-stop shop. I was the only person that was playing the Trash Can Snatchers. I vividly remember getting, you know, a demo in from a group from Coatbridge called Unity Express, who were two brothers, Patrick Kane on vocals and Gregory Kane on piano and keyboards. And they were, that was a forerunner for Hue and Cry. And even in a crudely recorded cassette tape, you could hear the quality of not only the song, but of Pat Kane's voice. And I gave them their first ever radio play. It was a song called Love is the Master.
Yeah.
And another great example of that was a guy came up to me. I used to DJ in Night Moves in Tucky Hall Street. And a guy came up to me one night in Night Moves, and he had an English accent. And he said, oh, I've got a band, and, you know, here's my cassette, you know. And you were, strictly speaking, forbidden from playing cassettes, but I just used to play them under the radar. And it was a song called The Power of Love, and his group were called The Casuals. And I played it like, you know, 4 or 5 weeks in a row. And all these record companies started to phone him, and he was freaking out because he didn't know what to do. We had these A&R guys calling him because they'd heard the track in my radio show. And he phoned his mate, or sent a message to his mate who was doing a gap year touring around Europe, hitchhiking around Europe. He says, look, Sloan's playing my record on the radio. I don't know what to do. You need to come back. All these record company guys are calling up. And he gets signed by Polydor Records, changed the name of the group from The Casuals to The Commotions, and Loy Cole and The Commotions were born. And a few months later, they were in the studio, and a few months after that, they were on Top of the Pops with Perfect Skin. So, fantastic. You know, that's how the magic happens.
I'm aware we have about 8 minutes left. Your show has, you have championed bands, lots of Scottish bands. Simple Minds are my favourite band.
Yeah.
And it was great that you have championed that band all the way through.
Yeah, I was lucky enough. I went to see their first gig in January of 1978, and there was a punk rock gig at Satellite City, which was the disco up above the Apollo. And top of the bill was a reggae band called Steel Pulse. Second in the bill was a band called Revolting and the Backstabbers, who morphed into James King and the Lone Wolves. First on the bill was a band called the New Sonics, who a few months later changed their name to Orange Juice. And Sandwich in the Middle, third on a four-band bill, were Simple Minds. And I just remember them walking on stage. You know, there was Charlie Burchill in guitar, there was Duncan Barnwell and Tony Donald, there was Brian McGee, and there was this singer who had a kind of quite crude pudding bowl haircut, and he had black tight jeans and sort of winkle picker boots, and he had a black priest frock coat like you would see a clergyman wearing that he'd bought from Paddy's Market, you know, for, you know, 5 shillings or something. And he looked really ill at ease, as if he'd rather be anywhere other than that place in front of 300-400 people. And he was so compelling. I'd never seen anybody like him before in my life, and it was Jim Kerr. And it was significant. I mean, could I have predicted that the band would go on to play Live Aid, have a number one record in America, a number one in the record in the UK? The answer is no. I could never have predicted that they would have gone on to become the most successful Scottish rock band in the history of music. But I think it was significant that of the four bands on the bill, I focused in on them. And I went round the back and chapped the door after they came off, and the door was opened by Charlie Burchell, who I didn't know, I'd never spoken to him before. And I said, look, mate, I'm doing a review of the gig. What's your singer called? Jim Kerr, K-E-R-R, yeah, K-E-R-R. And that's how I got to know them. And they've been great with me over the years. I mean, Jim has done the foreword for the book. He's one of my closest friends in the world. And, you know, I've been all around the world with them. Went to Rio de Janeiro and hung about with Ronald Biggs, a great train robber who was still on the run. And we played a game of football against the Brazilians, and the match was abandoned for fighting. And I've been at Wembley Stadium. I've been at the SEC, the Barlands. So I've had a great relationship with the guys, and, you know, and long may it continue.
Yeah. And, of course, a friendship for over 40 years.
Yeah, because when he was writing the foreword, I said, look, you know, feel free to put the boot in. I'm quite happy. And we did a little interview last week. And he actually said, you know, him and Charlie were in the studio, and he said, what listeners don't know is that when Sloan goes on tour with Simple Minds, we've got a nickname for him, and it's Alive and Eating. He says, because he says, if you're ever looking for Sloan at a Simple Minds gig, he's easy to find. He's usually in catering, stuffing his fat face. So I thought he was going to do all that stuff in the foreword, but he completely flipped and went all dead serious, and he said in the thing that, you know, I was his blood brother, yep. And he told me he loved me, and it was a really kind of emotional moment, because he's big, tough Jim Kerr, and he doesn't say things like that. You know, he's built from rain and granite, and, you know, he said I was one of his closest friends, and he's never told them that he loved them, but he loves them. And that was a big moment for me, because I thought I was going to get roasted alive.
There are some heart-tugging moments in the book. That's one of them. The other one, and we won't talk about it, I will leave that for the people, the story with Claire.
Oh, from Claire Alter Grogan. Of all the interviews I ever did for the Daily Record Sunday Mail in 33 years, it was an interview I did with Claire after her and her husband, a lovely guy called Stephen Laroney, who'd also been the guitar player in Altered Images. They tried very unsuccessfully to start a family. I don't know what was going wrong. And then they'd gone down the IVF route, and they'd kind of tried three versions of that, and it hadn't worked, and it's supposed to be three strikes and you're out. But they tried an extra one just for luck. And then, you know, that wasn't happening either. So they decided after a few years that they were going to adopt a child. And they adopted this wee girl, and it was a two-year, you know, roller coaster ride of, you know, proving that they were eligible and they were suitable to, you know, be the parents to this little girl. And I went down and interviewed Claire. It was the first interview. And at one point, as I say in the book, you know, she was the wee girl who was called Luca at that point, but her name's Ellie. Luca was her middle name. And she was only a few months old at the time, and she's sitting in the carpet with her dollies and her building bricks and her toys, playing, looking up at her mother, who's Claire. And Claire's in floods of tears, and I've got tears running down my face, and we've just sat and held hands on the couch, and I said we could kind of took a little bit of a time out. Then you spin on something like 16 years, 17 years, and that was at a gig a couple of years ago at the concert hall, and Claire was playing with Altered Image. She says, I want you to meet somebody, and she took me in backstage, and there's this teenager sitting with her phone and her headphones, and she says, this is Ellie, and I'm getting goosebumps just thinking about it. I said, Ellie, I said, this is actually the second time I've met you. You won't remember the first time, but you were only a baby the first time. And it's just, of all the interviews I ever did over the years, that was my favourite. And I phoned Claire up. I said, I want you to write about it in the book, but I wouldn't dream of doing that
without your permission.
And she said, I'd be quite happy for that. I said, do you still have the original article? Because I didn't have it in the Sunday Mail. And she had a copy of it, because I didn't want to do it from memory. And we reproduced it, and I sent it down to her to make sure that I'd get everything right, and she was happy with what I'd written, and she says, you've had me in tears again, and all that. And I says, well, it's such a great story. So that's one for the book. That's a lovely, lovely story, you know, when you pick up a tabloid newspaper and it's all doom and gloom, but this was one occasion where it was just such a heartwarming story.
Billy, I have no doubt you and I could sit here and talk for another 2 hours.
Yeah, I'm sure we
could. So many great stories in the book, and obviously stories that aren't in the book. One last question before we play the last track. We're both music lovers of a certain age, Billy. Do you think there could still be one new band or artist that could come through and really rock our boats?
I hope there would be, but my heart of hearts, you know, is there going to be another band like the Beatles or something? I asked McCartney that question when I interviewed him in 2018 at the Hydro, and he says, there's a lot of great bands out there. I'd love it to happen, but being realistic, I don't think a band or Connie come along and have the cultural and the musical significance that John, Paul, George and Ringo had in the early 60s. I don't see it happening, but if it does, I'll be delighted.
Billy, thank you very much for coming on the show.
Thank you for inviting me. I really appreciate that.
Billy Sloan, One Love, One Life, Stories from the Stars is out now. And I can tell you, it is well worth a read. Billy, we're going to end up. We'll get a minute or two of Simple Minds. This is Alive and Kicking. All the best with the book. I know you've got some dates coming up. We will bump into each other, a couple of them.
Good luck, Ronnie. Thanks for inviting me. Thank you.
Right, cheers, Billy.